Take your notes. Hey, we've been talking about the modern family during our series. And the big idea this weekend, you can write it in your notes, is family hardships become family health. And here's the thing, it's not that bad, but the truth is that in our families, sometimes we have hardships. And the idea is that God can bring healing during hardships. And healing is something that happens when things aren't working the way God designed them. So if you break your arm, you have to have it healed because it isn't working the way God designed it. And during hardships is when God can do some of the greatest healings. And so let's jump right in. This is our last weekend of the series. How is it that God uses hardship to cause healing? Take a look in your notes. Let's read something from the Bible to give this some credibility. I'll read it to you. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are illegitimate children and not true sons. Moreover, we've all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Now, this comes from a letter that was written in the Bible. We call it the Book of Hebrews. And it was to a group of people, and primarily families, that many of them had become Christians, but not all of them, large group of people. And what they had hoped is if they became a Christian, all their hardships would go away. And so life doesn't work like that. And actually, God uses hardships, doesn't always make them go away. So they're really discouraged and they're disappointed and at the point of giving up. And so the writer sends them off this letter to tell them that don't give up, because the hardships that you're going through, God's going to actually use those hardships to cause healing in your life. And so it's this pretty young church and this large group of people that get this. And When you think of a hardship, there's this. When Jesus was around, they spoke Greek. Most people spoke Greek, and so this part of the Bible was originally written in Greek. And this idea where it says that there's training, the word there actually was gymnasio. It was where we get the idea of gymnasium. And what it's talking about is that hardships, oftentimes, it feels like when you're exercising, it takes exercise in life to get stronger. Now, I brought a little sermon illustration today. We get the little barbell that I brought here today. Now, this shows you right off the bat. And don't be like, I know you're thinking, well, is this a girl barbell? But like, this is my barbell right here that I do my exercise with. And see, now the thing is, I do lots of these, though. The kind of exercise, I do a lot of them. Now here's the crazy thing about exercise, is like, the more you do these, like, well, I should say when I do curls, you know. Someday down the road when I do curls, or if I were to do curls, you know. So you're doing curls like this right here. And here's the crazy thing about it. The more curls you do and the harder it becomes, it seems like you're getting weaker. Like even right now, I feel the blood rushing. I'm about ready to pass out right now. But I mean, you know, as you're doing it right here, it's the oddest thing, because here you go, you're going like this. But actually, when you think about exercise, what exercise is it makes it hard on our muscles. And of course, they start screaming and saying, I would much rather be in bed. You know, and resistance. And there's hardship. This is what exercise is. It means when we make it hard for our muscles to do their work. And then, of course, as you're doing the work and you continue to do the work, you actually kind of feel weaker. It's like, can I lift this one more time? You know, but actually what's happening is you're becoming stronger. And families are like that. You go through hardships in families and you think, this is all flying apart. And I mean, what's happening to my family? Why is everything like this? And it can feel like it's weaker than it's ever been. But actually what's happening is you're going through a process that God can use to make you stronger and heal you. Because that's what exercise is like. Now, not everybody likes exercise, because exercise is difficult. It's not easy to go through exercise, but it can cause something. It can cause you to see what once was used to sort of like totally knock the family out. Now you have the strength and the healing to go through things. And there's some things that can be caused by it. Now, let's look at some of those things. Look in your notes here, just on the very first thing where it says humility. So if you're in the gymnasium, oh, and by the way, here's one thing about muscles. The older you get, the more you need to work out because your muscles get rigid. I remember when I first became a Christian, I was a very new Christian, and what I wanted the most was to become an old Christian. Because I thought when I become an old Christian, I'll have it all figured out, I'll know everything, I'll be really super strong spiritually, I won't have any hardships anymore because I'll know everything. And maybe you met someone like I dreamed to be that thought they knew everything and everything's going to be smooth now, no more hardships. Life doesn't work that way when you become a Christian. Do you know the longer you know Jesus, the more important it is to be open-minded. Or you can become very, very rigid. And when some people look at the church, they see just a very rigid set of ideas. And then they think it's just a very rigid group of people. And one of the things that amazed them about Jesus when he came is he was so open-minded. In fact, the church of the day would come to him and say, "Do you know who was at church today? They're with that other group of people. And do you know the type of things that they've done?" The church of the day would always be caught off guard by how open-minded he was. And the longer you're with God, the more open-minded you want to become so you can keep growing. Become flexible enough to grow. When you get older and older and older and older, my grandpa was a great athlete. And then when he got older and older, he didn't exercise. He didn't keep exercising. And he was amazed at the lack of strength that he had. As I thought, the older you get, the more you have to exercise. And so understand, the longer you know Jesus, the more important it is to be open-minded. It's very easy to look at the notches on your belt and say, "Well, I mean, I've been around a while." And you get rigid. And then people look at the church and they go, "I can't go there. I can't be with Jesus. I can't measure up to that." East Lake Church is an open party. Everybody can come. Open party. So let's look what it causes. Look here in your notes. Humility. "My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. And do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as his son." There's a senator recently that treated his staff really super bad. And he was just like one of those big puffed up, "Look at who I am." And so this one young man that was writing speeches for him, it was a handpicked speechwriter. He never thanked him. He never acknowledged him. He just, took the speeches and act like he'd written them, and never even privately acknowledged him. And so this young man at one point had just had his fill of the criticism in this pompous senator. So he tells him right before one of his big events, he says, "This is the last speech I'm writing for you. And I quit." The senator grabs it out of his hand. He goes, "Who needs you anyways? The people come to see me." So he gets up on the platform. He's got, the perfect smile. And this could happen to anybody. It's like the higher you go, the more you have to remember that that it's gratitude and humility that causes the people around you to want to be with you. And so he's forgotten that, but he gets a lesson because he looks at the speech and says, "I want to welcome everybody today, and especially the people that have supported me, and I want to thank you for all the things that you've done." And he turns over the first page, and handwritten it says, "It's all, you're on your own, you old blowhard." And every page was blank. So, you got to watch it in life. You can kind of sail away, and all of a sudden, they bring you down a little bit. And one of the things that happens during hard times is it's an opportunity to become humble, which isn't easy. I told you some of this was written in Greek, and there's this word for training. It means pediatrics. We get our word for pediatrics or pediatrician comes from this Greek word. And so you know what a pediatrician is. A pediatrician is someone that their whole life is about the welfare of the child. But sometimes this idea of discipline, sometimes this idea, the English idea doesn't carry that. It feels more like punishment or payback when someone disciplines you. And you may have had somebody in your life that's an authority figure. And when they disciplined you, it felt like punishment. In fact, if you're in authority and you get to be with people and you get to oversee them, it's a great thing to remember is like, you know, who is your correction about? Is it about their welfare or is it about what you need to for yourself? And sometimes, you know, it can be our parents, it can be an extended family member, it can be a boss, it can be a teacher. And the way they disciplined us felt like payback. And if you're a parent, you know what it's like to be a parent, and you have your children and you want to correct them in something. One woman said, before I got married, I had 6 theories on being a parent. Now I'm married with 6 kids and I have no theories. Because, you know, I mean, you get into it, and sometimes you get angry, you feel disrespected, and you can, you know, parenting is a mixed bag. But with God, it's not. The word to describe here, this word for discipline, is pediatrics. It's the person that's especially assigned to the child to bring out everything the best in the child, to bring out the hidden, completely focused, 100%, every millimeter of correction is for good and 100% love. That's what the word means. So if you've come today and you're still hurting because someone disciplined you harshly, and maybe that causes you to take a step back from God, like, I don't, you know, God's not like that. He doesn't need anything from you. He doesn't going to pay you back for anything. He's not correcting you for his benefit. He's the great pediatrician. He's all about you when he disciplines. And it is hard to go through discipline. You know, it's difficult to be corrected. And this idea of fatherly discipline, or like, let's say, godly discipline, let me tell you what it's like. Doesn't it seem like in the world that we live in, on the outside, there's all kinds of brokenness? So you look around and there's social injustice, and there's poverty, and there's wars that seem so silly, and there's great differences in economics and people that have and people that don't have, and just honestly, you just look around. I mean, you take a heavy dose of news and you're like, this world we live in, there's just a lot of brokenness around. But honestly, then there's brokenness inside of us too. You're jealous, hard not to be jealous. Somebody else gets something at work that you feel you should get or you want, it's hard not to be jealous. Hard not to be bitter. Hard not to be judgmental. You know, it's difficult when you can see the world on the outside and you think, well, this isn't an easy place to live, really. And then you look on the inside and you go, well, I have a lot of brokenness inside me too. I do foolish things. I get self-absorbed. And I'm just talking about me. You know, and these are the things on the inside. And here's what godly discipline is. And check this out. It's how God uses all of the outside brokenness in just the right way to heal our inside brokenness. So somehow he's able to orchestrate all the things that go on the outside, and they're broken. And what they should do is they should compound our brokenness. They should make it worse on us. We're already broken on the inside, and now we have to live in a broken place. And what God does is he takes all the outside stuff and he orchestrates it to heal us on the inside. So he takes all the things that make us jealous, and they cause us to be content. He takes all the things that would cause us to make really foolish choices, and he uses them to show us and to develop us, and so we can become wise. He takes all the things in life that make me think about myself, and it's all about me, and I'm all that, and a bag of chips, you know. So he takes all that stuff, and he shows us that isn't really, the world and the universe does not revolve around me. Right after I became a Christian, I came out of such a hard situation, you know, a lot of partying and stuff like that, and a lot of people that were very self-centered. And I was talking to my pastor one time, and he just said, Robin, someday you're going to learn the universe doesn't revolve around you. And I was like, it doesn't? Whew. You know, that put a light, you know, it's like. But God uses all the exterior things to heal us on the inside. And it's all through the Bible. A cool story in the Bible is about a family. This family, Abraham, had a wife, and they have this miraculous son. And he has this son, Isaac, and then Isaac has 2 sons, Esau and Jacob. And they're the great, 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 great people of Jesus. They're his family. So it all starts with this one guy. And isn't that amazing? The Jewish nation can trace everybody back to one guy. And so there's the one guy, Abraham. So this guy, Isaac, has these two sons, Esau and Jacob. And Jacob, he's a real conniver. You know, he's always pulling a fast one. And so he gets in a lot of trouble with his family because he's a type of person that's always thinking how he can leverage life for his benefit. And finally gets him in a lot of trouble with his family members, and basically he gets kicked out and he has to go live somewhere else. He finds a wife there and he starts to raise a family, and he has all these kids. He has 12 sons. I mean, he's just would do great in Utah. I mean, he's just got the huge family. And so, you know, he's got all these sons, and the last son's name is Joseph. And like a lot of times, Joseph's the baby of the family. So I don't know if you're the last one, if you're the baby of the family, but a lot of times, you know, oh, the baby of the family, you know. And so he starts to spoil Joseph, and it just starts wrecking the family. Because the other sons, they're not happy with it, you know. They're not okay with this kid always getting, you know, everything. And so Joseph, because he gets spoiled, he starts to become a very self-centered person, very egotistical person, very prideful person. And it starts to really ruin his life, which it always will. And so then God starts to use the outside stuff. His brothers hatch a plan, and they sell this guy off as a slave to some traveling salesmen that take him down to Egypt. And you can go in the book in Genesis and read it. It's a few chapters. It's an interesting story. So now he ends up in a completely different country. He doesn't speak the language, and guess what? He's not being spoiled anymore. He's like a house servant in some guy's house. But apparently he was a really handsome dude, you know. So the wife of the guy that, you know, that he's the slave for, she gets like a mad crush and starts lusting for him and says, you know, come to bed with me, you know. And Joseph's like, oh, you know, but he doesn't do it, you know. But there's the circumstance on the outside to heal. I'm all that. I'm the center of the universe. And then he gets thrown in prison. And so now he's in prison and he doesn't have anything. And you watch this story, and a lot of hardship in this family. Dad's back home in Israel thinking, I'll never see my son again. All the brothers are lying. We don't know what happened. He just went out to play and never came back, you know. So, I mean, that's what's going on in the family. A lot of hardship. And God's using all of it. And do you know, eventually, Joseph, through a set of circumstances, becomes a great man. And he's used to rescue the family. They have this huge, like, catastrophe throughout the world. And God orchestrates to where all the family comes back together. And now Joseph, because he's a great man, he rises up through the ranks of Egypt, becomes this great leader. He's able to rescue his family. And at the very end of his life, all of his brothers come to him, and they're trying to figure this out. And Joseph says, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. How would your family be different if you looked at it from that perspective? What's the hardest thing going on in your family? And, you know, you're just like, oh, you know, you're just barely able to do it. You know, like, this, like, sucks. You know, you're just, and it's so hard. What's the hardest thing going on in your family? It's normal. And God uses the hardships to cause healing. That's the good news. He uses them. Now, there's ways that we squirm out of humility. I mean, earlier in this letter, it talks about, you know, the different ways that family works. And it says, you know, don't make light of the Lord's discipline. So see if you recognize this type of a child. There seems to be two type of children. So one child, you know, you think they tell a lie. And they're supposed to go to Jimmy's birthday party on the weekend. And Thursday you go to him, you say, listen, you know what? You didn't do your homework, did you? You came home after school and went out when I told you not to, didn't you? And, you know, you told a lie, didn't you? So one child says, yes, okay, I told a lie. Well, you're not going to Jimmy's birthday party. Well, you go to your room. You know, you're going to stay in your room. You're not going to Jimmy's. But that's not fair. They cried. I'm going to die. It's going to be the worst. You just shut the door and go. That's the way to handle that. But anyways, you know, this isn't, I'm sorry. Then finally later, he says, I'm not going to lie anymore. You know, so they kind of work it out, you know. Then there's this type of child. Did you come home and do your homework, or did you go out and play? Because Sally's mom told me she saw you. Are you lying? Yes, I lied. I wanted to go play. I lied. Okay, well, you're not going to Jimmy's birthday party this weekend. You go to your room. Here's the child. Fine. I didn't want to go to Jimmy's birthday party anyways. Ever seen that child? That's the child that's making light of the discipline. It's not getting in. That's the child that sees their parents as the enemy somehow. That's a hard child. Because you have to sit with that child. And you have to convince that child how much you love them. You have to be patient with that child. Because here's the tendency as parents sometimes is go, you're way easier. He didn't cry, he didn't slam the door, he didn't break anything. You're in your room quietly, you know, not bothering me. And you have to be careful with that child. You have to be willing to sit with that child and talk with that child. You have to be willing to help that child understand that, you know, if you keep lying, nobody's going to trust you. And here's what's worse, and I speak from experience, when you develop a habit of lying, the worst part is you don't trust anybody. Nobody trusts you, but that's not the worst part. The worst part is you can't trust anybody because you think everybody's like you. So you can't trust anyone. When you have a child, they start to develop habits and they make light of the discipline. That's the child that you're on your knees praying. God, they don't see me as an advocate. They don't see me as someone that loves them yet. They don't see me as someone that's for them. And you know, there's lots of big children in the world walking around that they don't see God that way. That's why it's so important that as a church that we don't make people jump through religious hoops. Because when they see those things, when they see all the things they have to change and all the rules that they have to keep, and when that's what we lead with, these are all the things you have to do, and what they think is that, well, you're not for me. You want me to be like you. And then it's a very small step to see God that way. You know why Jesus decided to go and leave a church behind? So we could be the bridge. So people would see us and they go, well, if God looks like them. You got this little thing for Easter, chilling with my peeps, Easter 2012. So we got the news. This facility only closes one time a year and it's on Easter. So I'm thinking, oh, come on. We just got started out here. You're not going to, you know, we can't meet on Easter. So we started thinking what we could do, and we thought, well, we'll rent someplace. And we looked around. We can't find any place to rent. We're trying to think, what are we going to do? We have to have an Easter service. And then somebody said, well, why don't we just throw a party? And of course, you know, me, my background, Mr. Old Religious Guy, that party on Easter. What is there to celebrate? You know, party, okay. So here's what we're doing, and everybody's invited. We're going to, again, come to my house, see how I live. We're going to invite everybody to my house, anybody and everybody, and we're going to have a party on Easter. And it's actually going to be a party. I mean, there's going to be an array of beverages. I'll leave it right there, but an array of beverages. And there's going to be a barbecue, and we're going to have food and music, and we're going to hang out. And the whole thing's going to be a party that day because, listen, if people got that God was willing to party. And I don't mean sin now. I'm not talking about rave type parties. You know, I'm talking about a party heart. A smile, dancing, laughing, drinking, eating, telling jokes, playing games, wrestling with children, having fun. If people got that about God, Jesus showed up that way and they said he's a drunkard and he hangs out with the wrong people and he even lets prostitutes come to church. This guy can't be from God. He's not religious enough. So we're having a party on Easter. Invite whoever you want to the Easter party. Because there's little kids and there's big kids that when God moves to use the hardships in their life, they back up. That you can't possibly love me. How could a loving God let these things happen to me? Boy, and those are the people that need the most patience. The very most. So it's kind of a way that we squirm out of it a little bit. You know, and here's this other one. It says, and don't lose heart. So there's two sides. There's the person that takes the hardships, and I don't take it seriously. I make life. But here's the other one. This is kind of the American way. It's like the people that lose heart. It's the times in life that you feel like, I shouldn't have to go through this. It's when the hardship turns us back on ourselves and all we can see is ourselves and we lose heart. And one of the ways that we miss the opportunity to be healed is all we can think about is how bad it is for me. And it doesn't seem like self-pity is a form of pride, but think of the word self. It's a dangerous form of living because you're thinking of yourself all the time. And I've discovered I'm most miserable when my eyes are on me. And so there's a couple different ways you get out of being. And here's the crazy thing. When everything is like going crazy in life and really, really bad, and you feel bad about yourself and you're sorry for yourself and you feel really sorry, you don't feel like you're stuck in pride. You go, you're being, what are you talking about, man? My life's in the toilet. This is the worst, man. I got the worst life. It is so hard to see that the focus is me. Now, the second thing in looking at your notes is evaluation. And so let's read this together. Once in a while we do. So there's two things. The first one, humility comes out of hardship. Second, evaluation. So look here, we're going to read this little verse together nice and loud so everybody's with me. So grab your notes if you have it. And if you don't, it'll come up on the screen here. And so here it goes right here. 1, 2, 3. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. Yeah, so evaluation. Here's one of the things that happens when hardships comes in life is I have an opportunity to see who I am. Do you know why when you go to the gymnasium, you wear the tank top and the shorts and stuff like that? You know why most of us don't run around like that all the time? Because we don't want to see that much of our own bodies and we don't want anybody else to see it. I mean, we wear clothes for a reason. When you go to the gymnasium and you have a little tank top on and shorts and you walk by a mirror, you realize why you're at the gym. And the gym will always reveal who I am. And hardship will too. If your worldview, if your idea of life, if your meaning of life is like mine can be, I need to be comfortable, then you'll always try to get out of hardship. And when hardship happens, you'll be like, well, how come I have to be in this hardship? This isn't fair. And by the way, part of the hardest thing about hardship comes with our expectations of hardship. I mean, one of the most difficult things is when hardship comes my way and I'm in shock and I don't feel like I should have to go through it. I had surgery on my rotator cuff a couple years ago. And it's not a big, huge surgery, but it's a pretty painful surgery. I'll say that for it. And so here's one of the things they do nowadays is that when you go into surgery, they bring a surgical nurse down to talk to your family and all your friends before they see you. So the surgical nurse comes down and says, now listen, when you see him, his hair is going to be all messed up and his eyes are going to be rolled back in his head. He's going to have tubes everywhere. He's got drool coming out of his mouth. He's going to look kind of clammy. And it's okay, though. That's how they look when they come out of surgery. So they set your expectation. And so now when you go see that person, two things happen. One, you look at him and go, yeah, looks just like the girl said, woo. Or you go, hey, they don't look as bad. But before they had surgical nurses, they usually just haul us back in there by ourselves, and we see him, and we look like, woo, but press the button, man. He looks like he's dying now. He's got blood and tubes coming everywhere. He's like, look at him. He's like a blue-green. Because you didn't expect to see that. And when you expect in your families to not have hardship, you're so shocked that you're going through it. That's part of the pain. And it's during the evaluation time that you begin by saying, well, this is normal to have hardship in family. And I told you, my exercise is called CrossFit. So it's this exercise. You only do it for about a half hour and use small amount of weights like this, but you do lots and lots of repetitions as fast as you can, and there's no breaks. So like push-ups, and sit-ups, and jump rope, and pull-ups, and you do it like for a solid minute, and then they give you a 10-second break, and then you go to the next one. So you get down on the ground, you do push-ups for a solid minute as fast as you can. Then they blow a whistle, and you get a 10-second break, and then you go on to the next one. You only do 5 of these events, but you do them, and then when you get done with one set, you do the next one right away again. Let me tell you, that 10 seconds begins to be something you crave. And in that type of exercise, There's a lot that's revealed about yourself, because when you first hear, the very first time I ever went, well, what are we going to do? Oh, we're going to do sit-ups and push-ups and pull-ups. I said, pfft. Oh, no, and then they told me, they said, we're going to jump rope. I said, jump rope? Can you jump rope, Robin? Pfft. Girls in elementary school jump rope. I could jump rope. Give me the rope. Let me tell you what, man, about the fifth set of jumping rope, when you can't pick up the rope, you got both hands and your foot trying to get it up, and you hit it and hit you in the back of the head. You're just playing, you know, it's like, you know. It's revealing. Now listen to this. What's being revealed about you and your family in the hardship that you're going through? You don't have to run from it. One of the best things about being with Jesus is I don't have to fear my sin. I spent my whole life afraid of my sins. Every time I saw them, they scared me to death. And so I worked as hard as I could to not see them. But they have a way of creeping in. And I blame other people and try to pretend and do whatever I could to numb myself, because I was just afraid of my sins. And then I met Jesus. And I didn't have to be afraid of him anymore. I could just be honest about who I was and the sin in my life. And I wasn't afraid of my sin anymore, because he was with me, and I got that he accepted me. And no matter what I found out during the workout in the gymnasium when I was with the pediatrician, I didn't have to be afraid of it anymore. It's the evaluation time. Now the third thing here. Look, perseverance. And let's run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Same letter. And he uses this analogy of a race, and it's probably the pentathlon. In that day, the greatest race in Greek Olympics was the pentathlon. So you would run, and you would jump, and you'd do the discus and the javelin in five events. And the fifth event, though, was a wrestling match. So think about this. You go on a long, long run, and then you get done, and then you get to do a jumping event, and then you have to throw a discus, and then a javelin, and then when all that's done, you have to wrestle a guy. And is that like family? When you've done a lot, you've worked really hard, you've had lots and lots of events, and you're tired now, and now the hardest thing comes in my family? That's called teenagers. We're going to go through the hardest thing now after all this stuff that's already made me tired? What are you tired about in your family? And just over the horizon, you see something on the way and you're like, what? I don't have the strength for that. I'm already too tired. Jesus brought you here today to tell you that when you're tired, he's not. I wish I had known that when I was a kid. Because it's easy to quit, especially on family. I know. I was 14 years old and I quit on my mom. And our background was intense alcoholism in our family ever since second grade. And I hung in there and I hung in there, and finally the alcoholism just wore me down. And I remember the moment that I quit, actually. I remember the exact moment that I just quit on her. And I know you can say, hey, Robin, come on, you were young, you didn't have a dad, you were overwhelmed, and all of that's true, but I still quit. And you know the worst thing about being young in my family and quitting, the very, very worst thing, is that I didn't understand that when you quit on someone, you detached from them. And they're not a person anymore. They're just a problem. I was 14 years old and I didn't have a mother anymore. At least before that, I had a mother. She was an alcoholic and really hard to live with, but at least she was my mom. But when I quit, she just became a problem. I was completely detached from her. And listen to me, man. When you detach from a person, and this is what I didn't know, it is really hard to get them back. That was one of the tragedies of my life, was that at that age, I didn't know that. Nobody could sit down with me and tell me, listen, Jesus is with you. I know it's hard, but don't quit, because if you quit, you'll detach. It's going to be really hard to, you know, nobody told me that. So I made a young, ill-advised decision. And I lost her. Who's so hard for you and your family? You're entertaining quitting? And it doesn't even seem wrong. And I don't want this to come as a heavy or as a put down that it is wrong, because that's not the point. The point is Jesus can help you persevere so you don't have to. If you've been contemplating quitting, that is so normal, and I get it. And don't spend a moment beating yourself up. That's normal. I can't go on anymore. But then know that Jesus is with you to keep you going. You don't have to quit. It's hard to love people that are hard to love. Of course, we all take our turn where we're the hard person to love. But it's hard. It's difficult with our children, especially. They grow up and they just end up different than you think. You know, and things come up in your families, and there's highs and lows, and they become difficult to love. And, you know, it'd be nice if they were all like when they were in the little bassinet, like little angels. You know, she's like, oh, you know, this is so nice. You know, so. But when they get older, I hate you. How come? You didn't buy Pop-Tarts. Come on. It's hard to love people in our families when they're hard to love. But the reality is that a lot of that goes on in families. It's a real part of it. And I like this little thing I brought here. Don't tease me about it. It's a nursery rhyme, okay? It's a nursery rhyme in church. But listen to this. It's the skin horse had lived longer than any of the other little toys in the nursery. He was so old that his brown coat was bald in patches and showed the seams underneath, and most of the hairs in his tail had been pulled out to be used as string for beaded necklaces. But he was wise, for he had seen a long succession of mechanical toys arrive to boast and swagger by and by, but eventually they became broken. They never turned into anything real. For nursery magic is very strange and wonderful, and only those playthings that are old and wise and experienced, like the skinned horse, understand all about it. "What's real?" asked the Velveteen Rabbit one day when they were lying side by side in the nursery. "Does it mean having things like a buzzer inside you or a stick-out handle?" The skinned horse said, "Real isn't how you're made. It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." "Does it hurt?" asked the rabbit. "Well, sometimes," said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. "But when you're real, you don't mind being hurt." "Does it happen all at once, like being wound up?" he asked, "or bit by bit?" "Oh, it doesn't happen all at once," said the skin horse. "You become real. It takes a long time. And you have to be able to go to Jesus to persist, to go through the long time, to have the real love with family." Now, so far in this talk, it's sort of like we've been talking about the engine. But every engine needs gas. An engine is just an engine until it gets gas. And look at the good news here. You can depend on Jesus in your hardship. Let me read you about the gas. When he sees all that he accomplished, talking about Jesus here, when he sees all that is accomplished by his anguish, he will be satisfied, and because of his experience, my righteous servant will make it possible for many to be counted righteous, for he will bear all their sins. Here's what it means. There's just lots of hard things in family. And we don't have to bear them by ourselves. Don't be afraid of the word sin, because you're not on your own. It just means there's lots of stuff that is hard. And we don't bear it by ourselves. And here's the unique thing. You think about this. Why would Jesus get in the race? I mean, he was doing okay in heaven. Why would he come here to be with us? Why would he get involved in our race? One of the things that's so unique about Christianity is that we have a God that's willing to go through hardship. Sometimes, you know, you get involved in the whole idea of the religion is all the people do hard things for God, and he sits with people waving fans eating grapes. That's not our God. Anguish. And it says that he was satisfied. Do you know the only thing that Jesus didn't have in heaven was you? Us. That was all that was missing. Everything else was there. But you. And he was and is so satisfied to go through any hardship so he can have you. We're going to take communion today, and if you grab these just for a second. We're a mobile church, and so this is the way we do communion. There's lots of different ways to do communion. We celebrate an open communion table so everybody can receive communion, and this is the way we do it. It's not the best, but we have to do it this way because we're mobile. And if you have a different tradition for communion, please bear with us. But you can open those up and just toss the tops on the ground somewhere. And so you hold the cup and the bread and this little wafer. And what communion is the picture of the hardship that God went through. It's the picture of the hardship. I guess it's both sides of the cross. It's the hardship going into the cross so he could be with you. And it's the joy coming out of the cross, of the resurrection, that he can be with you. And so, not to make this simple or trite, but I just want to say, here's the gas. Christianity is not about trying harder. It's about being glad you can admit that you can't try hard enough. This is the gas. So would you take the bread with me, and I'm gonna pray real quick. Jesus, in the scripture, and it's historical that you're a person, that you died on the cross, and your body went through an awful lot. You had a body just like us, and you died on the cross. And it was a hardship that you went through so you could be with us in our hardship. And so to say thank you, but more, to take that inside of us, to drive it deep into our being, we now receive this bread in Jesus' name. If you'll take this. And then here's the cup. And it does say in the scripture that his blood was spilled. And so it was a hard life. Jesus had a great life on earth, but he also went through a lot of hard things. And the cross was hard. The blood came then, and the agony came then. And what kept him on the cross is you. It says in the Bible he could snap his finger at any minute and call a legion of angels to take him away. He could have chose that. But what kept him there as he bled is you. Not us. You. You're the one that this blood was shed for. So I'm going to say a prayer. As we hold this in our hands, it's juice, Lord, but we're asking that it would somehow... and has through the centuries, it's become your blood. It's become the blood that speaks of the life that you lived and the life that you live inside of us. And no matter how hard it ever gets, no matter how hard our family is, no matter what we ever face, that this blood means that the hardship can become healing. It can become healing. And because of that healing, we hold this in our hand. We know it's hard, but we hold this blood in our hand right now, this juice that becomes your life, to say this: God, in the midst of everything hard in our life and our families, would you use it to heal us? We want to be healed in Jesus' name. Amen.